Joined.
Thank you very much. So welcome everyone to the IPv6 webinar for ALAC, ALAC and at large actually for our community. We have the chance today of having a number of people join us with guest speakers Leo Vigoda and also Jason Schiller, who will be speaking to us about a number of things today. But first, we have Leo, who will be speaking to us about a short introduction about IPv6, what it is, what does it enable. I think that most of our community know, but it's always good to have a good reminder of what it is. Leo Vigoda is from the Operational Excellence Manager of ICANN. Next, we'll have taking part in policy development in the 5 regional internet registry regions. You know, the ASO does not conduct its policy development within ICANN. It's conducted outside. And there is somehow, I think, a lot of, there are questions in our members' minds as to how does one get involved and, in fact, is one able to get involved with policy development as far as the members are concerned. Ricardo Patera and Jason Schiller, who are the ASO representatives, will be able to help us on this. And then after that, we will have a little update on the IPv4 address recovery policies. They, in some cases, are different in some regions, and in some are not. And in fact, I seem to recall there was some question about being able to have a uniform policy across the world. We'll know all about this, whether there is or whether there isn't, again, from Ricardo and from Jason. And finally, IPv6 allocation policies in the ESO's 5 regional internet registry regions. Policies are sometimes different, sometimes the same. It'll be good to have a good update on that. Finally, questions and answers. We might be running a little bit over time because I understand that the presentations are going to be quite extensive. So without any further ado, let's go to our agenda point number 2, the short introduction about IPv6. Leo, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Olivier. I'm scrolling down the slides. I don't know if everyone can see that, but for the overview of this, I'm starting with what is Internet Protocol, and I wanted to do that just to make sure that everyone has a good basic understanding of where we're coming from, going through IPv4, the design and development of IPv6, and then where we are with current deployments and some things that at large might want to consider for getting involved. So firstly, Internet Protocol is basically about sending messages. You break them up into small pieces and then you reassemble them at the other end. One analogy Vint Cerf sometimes uses is it's a bit like writing on postcards, but sometimes you send one postcard and you'll get two at the other end, because the way the network works is that sometimes it would prefer to deliver 2 copies if it doesn't get an acknowledgement that the first copy was successfully delivered, rather than not deliver anything. So the other similarity between Internet Protocol and postcards is that as Internet Protocol is as a default, there is no encryption or security built into it, at least in IPv4. And that was something that was added at a later date. Of course, key cryptography. Public key cryptography was only published as a concept in 1977 while Internet Protocol was being developed, and it wasn't computationally possible to deliver that kind of IPsec security in the initial IPv4, which, as you can see, was only really started in 1983. There have been several sort of little revisions to IPv4 as a protocol. So initially, there were just going to be 256 networks, and each of those networks would be about 16 million addresses, and that was considered fine for an experiment, because remember that Internet Protocol and the Internet as we now know it was started as an experiment. It wasn't expected that the experiment would have the tremendous success it's had, and that's one of the reasons that there are just over 4 billion IPv4 addresses. It wasn't considered important to have an experiment that would provide enough addresses for everyone in the world. Now, a couple of years after the experiment started, they said, you know, we've got a little bit of a success problem, and they introduced some additional technology, the classful concepts, class A, class B, class C, and different portions of the address space were set aside as having different sizes of network. So there were 127 of these class A's, which have 16 million addresses in them, and then another portion of the address space was set aside for class B networks, which would have 65,000 addresses, and another portion was set aside for class C networks that would have 256 addresses, basically small, medium, and large. And that worked well for a while, but by 1993 it was recognized that even this enhancement wasn't going to allow IPv4 of the ever-growing internet, and so some classless inter-domain routing was introduced, and that allows any size of network prefix, which is based on a power of 2. So you can have one address, or 2, or 4, or 16, or 32, so on in your network. So that's IPv4, and we've come up to the mid-90s. If I scroll forward into deploying IPv6, you can see at the same time that CIDR was being deployed, there was a protocol design competition for the next generation of Internet Protocol, because people recognized that IPv4 wasn't big enough. And the selection was made and standardized by 1995, and Sixbone, which was the experimental testbed network for IPv6, began operation in 1996. ICANN's IANA department actually made the first IPv6 allocations in 1999. And the Sixbone ended on the 6th of June 2006. So that was 666, and that was sort of like the overview of the design and deployment history up until the point where we have production. So we're now at the point where vast majority of the IPv4 address space has been fully allocated. Everyone who wants IPv6 address space can get their IPv6 address space and start deploying it on production networks. And about a year ago, the Internet Society led the world IPv6 deployment. And if you go and look at the the picture on this slide, you'll go and see that some of the networks here have well more than half of their traffic coming out over IPv6, and some significantly more than that, up towards 90%. Now, what this tells us, and admittedly these are the most highly deployed IPv6 networks, these results tell us that IPv6 is now a deployable production protocol, and you can get access to all your cool content with that. There are maps for deployment from Cisco, from Google, from APNIC, and they all use slightly different methodologies, but they all go and tell you basically the same kind of thing. Now, it's important that if you do buy and deploy network equipment, that you don't turn off IPv6. Apart from anything else, you might damage the security of your network. Christian Houtemar from Microsoft made this statement last week saying that Microsoft doesn't test Windows without IPv6 turned on, and if you go and disable IPv6, well, who knows what results you might get. You'll also have seen that the Microsoft's new gaming console relies on IPv6 with IPsec to work, and so if you don't have an IPv6 capable network, it will go and use a transition technology, a tunneling technology, which isn't quite as good as native. This is a console which is designed for the long term, and IPv6 is the future. So it relies on IPv6. Now, if you as at large are thinking, what should I be doing, what can I do, you might want to consider engaging with internet service providers, with regulators, and with over-the-top service providers, and asking, will the features that you use on the internet, will gaming, video, voice, maps, and so on work? Will audit trails work? So, for instance, if you are involved in any kind of financial transaction and you have to keep an audit trail of where stuff comes from, will that functionality work with IPv6 as well as it does with IPv4? So on. I know that at the Right meeting this week, they've been testing functionality on an IPv6 only network and found a significant amount of stuff that works seamlessly, and a few things that don't work on an IPv6 network. And especially when you're a service that runs over the network, it's important that you have IPv6 functionality built into your application, because without that functionality, your customers might no longer be able to be your customers. You won't have control over what network your customers use. So I've tried not to take too much time. I hope my introduction has been useful. I'm happy to take questions at any time, but I should hand back now. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Leo. That's very helpful and very concise. And thanks so much for sharing this with us. Will this presentation be available to our members to be able to download?
Yes, I believe it will be available both from the At Large site and also on the IANA site.
And Olivia, we can also send it out to our list. So all of the presentations on today's call, we'll send the presentations and the recording.
The link to the presentation and the recording, yeah, that's
right.
A perfect thing. Okay, Olivia speaking. So the floor is open for questions. I think the first question was actually a question from Glenn McKnight, and that was exactly the question which I addressed it quite independently. So that's fine. With regards to questions, I see Yaobi has put his hand up. Yaobi, after whom? You have the floor.
Thank you, Olivier, and thank you, Leo. Can you hear me, please?
Yes, I can hear you very well. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just have one question, because these days people are talking about IPv6 transition to IPv6. So my clear question is to know if there is a date when IPv4 network will stop working. Because why are we talking about, people are talking about transition to IPv6. From your explanation, I think both networks will continue working, talking to each other. Thank you.
Yep.
I think I should punt that question to someone from the ASO who actually runs the network, like Jason or Ricardo or Louis Lee, because I don't actually run a network. And I think it would be unfair for me to answer a question that they're going to be authoritative on.
So, Jason Schiller, I'm with Google. I'll go ahead and try and take a stab at this. I also was previously with UUNET and Verizon as a transit provider. Basically, for networks that continue to grow and their need for addressing continues to grow, they're going to eventually find difficulty in getting additional IPv4 space. So their options are going to be either stop growing, take IPv4 address away from low revenue-generating customers to make it available to high revenue-generating customers, or to simply do IPv6. Initially, what we're hoping in terms of the transition is to get all of the Internet to dual stack. So that means all of the servers and all of the clients speaking both IPv4 and IPv6. And that will allow, if there are IPv6-only networks to start showing up in the near future, that they could get to all of the content and all of the peer-to-peer networks that they need. Eventually, what you'll start to see is new content will show up on the network, and that might be IPv6 only, because as people turn up new servers, they might not have v4 addresses readily available. So eventually, if you're IPv4 only, you'll start to no longer be able to reach certain sites, certain new sites. But ultimately, we don't think people are going to turn off IPv4 in any short time period. There's likely to be some legacy embedded systems that still will only speak IPv4. Think about your HP Jet Direct card, for example. So likely what's going to happen is people will just transition all of the new growth to IPv6. At some point, when a small amount of traffic is V4, then providers might consider the cost of continuing to support V4 in their router configurations and whatnot, and consider turning it off. But that's a long time away.
Thank you very much, Jason. So, some people say 50 years. Is this real, considering the Internet itself and TCP/IP is no more than 35 years?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard estimations between 30 and 50 years before people just completely turn off IPv4, and I don't find that unreasonable.
Oh, wow.
In terms of the more important question is, when will all of the Internet be able to speak IPv6? And that could be as soon as 2 years or 5 or 10 years.
So it's Olivia speaking. So the question, I guess, if it's going to take a few more years, 2 or 5 years or so, and I understand this has been around for a while, why has it taken so much time to deploy IPv6?
Well, the issue is there is real cost involved in deploying IPv6. Oftentimes, old hardware has to be replaced. There's training issues. You have to get all of your staff trained up on IPv6. And what you get from deploying IPv6 is the ability to continue doing business as usual when IPv4 addresses run out. So there's added cost in terms of hardware upgrade. There's added complexity in terms of support. There's added security concerns that you have to address. There's, you know, you double your amount of testing that needs to be done to certify equipment. So there are significant costs involved in doing V6, and you don't get any new revenue, you don't get any new products, any new services. You just get to keep doing business as usual. So a lot of providers have tried to do the minimum in terms of testing and certification to make sure that their equipment supports IPv6 and turning it on anywhere that they can for free, but they've been trying to defer all the equipment upgrades until the last possible moment. So that way they will be able to do IPv6 everywhere just as IPv4 addresses are running out.
Okay. Thank you, Jason. Yaovi Atuhun, you have the floor.
Thank you. Yaovi speaking. Just a comment. I have a question about the term transition because I was in a meeting in Accra some days ago, ITU regional preparation meeting. When people were talking about the issue of digital broadcasting, you know, there is a deadline, 2015, to move from analog to digital TV broadcasting. So when people also in the meeting were talking about transition, I was thinking that is a little confusion. Because for internet, as you said before, I think IPv4 and IPv6 will continue working. The point is that IPv6 is providing more space. So the case is different from digital, from in the TV case. They are going to use the frequency for other things. But for IPv4, I think they will be working. So I'm glad that you said that. Maybe transition will mean preparing to dual stack. So IPv4 and IPv6 can be able to talk to each other together and not a deadline to stop IPv4. Me as a user, and the second question I want to take the opportunity to ask, how the user to care about this? Because for the user, doesn't mind, so it just wants internet. So what is the place for the end user, or why the end user should mind about this technical aspect. Thank you.
Thank you, Yobi. I'm not sure who wishes to answer those questions. Do we have a volunteer?
Could you repeat the question? I didn't hear it clearly.
So, Leo, I think that the short of the question, the comment was, we're not really transitioning away from IPv4. We really need to get to dual stack, and I think that that's spot on. But the question was, you know, why do users care about IPv4 or IPv6? They just care about getting to the Internet.
I completely agree with that. Users shouldn't need to know anything about how the Internet works. Users should just need to turn it on, and there it is, and it just works out of the box, and they don't need to do anything special.
Yeah, I think the complexity...
If I may say, this is Louis.
Go ahead, Louis.
Oh, yeah, the complexity itself is more than what most users are accustomed to. But what they will find is that at some point they'll find that there are certain websites they can't reach anymore if they are only on V4 and those V sites are only on V6, unless there's some kind of carrier-grade NAT or some sort of a tunneling technology in place that has to be consciously installed. It's not just going to be automatic for the most part. They will start seeing sites that they cannot reach, and that would be the kind of pressures that service providers will start hearing, either hearing via email directly to the website, or they will start complaining to their own ISPs.
So, Louis, it's Olivier speaking. So, effectively, you're only going to start seeing users pushing for IPv6 when things start getting broken. Is that correct?
That's how I see end users asking for V6.
That sounds very
unless you have the folks like you and me who are, yeah, yeah.
It's not painful.
But yeah, that's the chicken and egg problem.
And I guess, yeah, I guess that's where we're going. The chicken and egg problem is one of the major problems that we have with this, because it's a technology that end users are not really aware of. What they want is to have their Facebooks and their Gmail and their services running. They don't really care how they run. And I guess that's really one of the things is the industry itself. The ISPs need to plan for their future in order to keep their customers happy, and that's probably something which goes better in some ISPs than in others. I'm mindful of the time, and I think that we're on the subject of addressing, and I wondered whether we could skip part three for the time being, maybe moving it to further down in the call. And just continue speaking about addresses, and in particular the IPv4 address recovery policies. One of the ways to push back the day when an end user will try and access a website and will not be able to access that website and will get a blank screen or get an error instead, is to try and recycle IPv4 addresses. And for this we have Ricardo Pissarro and Jason Schiller, who will be able to provide us with more info on that, and specifically what's happening in the regional internet registries.
Sure, can we have the slide? Okay, so I'm going to do quick introductions, and then we'll do the RAR policy development at the end. My name is Jason Schiller. I'm an ASOAC member from the Aran region. I'm a network engineer for Google, and I also do the numbers administrations for Google. Ricardo, you want to introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you, Jason. My name is Ricardo. I'm the ASOAC representative from the LACNIC region. I currently work at Registro BR. It's a CCTLD register for the domain name .br, but we are also a national internet registry, so we allocate IP addresses and ASNs to ISPs and other organizations inside of Brazil.
And we've also got Louis Lee, who's the chair of the ASOAC, on the call. Louis, can you introduce yourself? Louis?
Sure, as soon as I unmute myself. Yes, can you hear me okay? Okay. Chair of the ASO Address Council. I am currently working at Equinix. Prior to Equinix, I was at Netcom, one of the first commercial internet service providers. My responsibility at Equinix does include working with all our customers and try to build products that are relevant to their needs. Our customers include all the very large carriers, all the very large content providers like Google, Facebook, and Yahoo, so on. We also have financial customers that would like to get together in the same data centers, and we have data centers all around the world.
Okay, so we're going to go ahead and jump right in, and first we'll talk about the status of IPv4 address space. The Number Resource Organization, the NRO, quarterly puts out statistics showing how much address space is left, and you can go to the website every quarter and see where we're at. This is the last time they did it, as of June, and it basically shows where all of the slash 8s are allocated. We've got these 91 central registry slash 8s. These are the pre-RAR allocations, sometimes called legacy addresses. We've got another chunk of addresses that are unusable, 35 of them. Those are allocated to things like multicast usage or Class E experimental usage. We've also got some private use stuff in there as well. And then the remaining 130 are broken out among the various regional internet registries. APNIC has the most, 45. followed by Aaron and Ripe, which have 36 and 35, and then Afronik and Lachnik have 5 and 9. On this next slide, this shows the allocations or assignments that the RIRs make to their customers. Their customers are either ISPs that turn around and give them to other downstream ISPs or customers, or they also make direct assignments to customers as well. And it's broken up by the five regions. This next slide is looking at what is the available inventory of each of the five RIRs. You'll see that Afronik has the most with almost 4/8, followed by Lachnik, which has 2.32, and Aaron with 2.32, and then Apnik and Ripe have less than 1. Both of those regions have created a soft landing policy where they've decided to designate the last /8 for special usage, and that's only for new organizations that don't have any addresses. So those two regions are essentially out at this point already, even though you do see some addresses in their inventory. This next slide is generated by Jeff Houston, who works for APNIC. He's been doing a lot of research on the drawdown of the IP addresses, and this is showing when Ripe and APNIC ran out, as well as the projections for Aaron, Lachnik, and Afronik. And he keeps this up on his website, Potteroo. You can check it daily, and he'll tell you when we're expected to run out. So we wanted to talk about IPv4 address recovery. So the easiest way to figure out if there is a policy for something in the different regions is to go to the NRO RIR Comparative Overview, the URL there at the top of the slide. And when you do that, you can quickly compare what are the policies for recovering unused resources, for example. In APNIC and LACNIC, a resource is valid as long as the original criteria continues to be met, and they actively recover unused resources. Resources of organizations who cease to exist, companies that go bankrupt, for example, are returned to the free pool for that particular region. RIPE is also very similar. They're valid as long as the original criteria continues to be met. And if an organization ceases to exist, they return to the free pool. Aaron is a little bit more different. They look at organizations that are out of compliance with the current Aaron policy, and those organizations are requested to return address space, and they can be compelled to return the address space. They also revoke resources for lack of payment and for fraud. We can actually dig down into the Aaron Number Resource Policy Manual and look at the various places where these policies come from. And it's fairly complicated to do because they're not all consolidated in one place. They have a Section 12 for resource review. And that basically says that Aaron can go back to an organization and review how they're using the addresses to make sure that they're efficiently utilized. And you'll find down here in bold a number of paragraphs down, organizations found by Aaron to be materially out of compliance with current Aaron policy shall be requested or required to return resources as needed to bring them into or reasonably close to compliance. And if an organization does not voluntarily return the resources as requested, Aaron may revoke any resources issued by Aaron as required to bring the organization into overall compliance. There's a lot of policy surrounding the review. Aaron can do a review at any time it deems, as long as it hasn't done one in the last 2 years. They can do one when you come back for additional resources, or they can do one if they have a suspicion of fraud. Aaron also has an annual renewal. They require everyone holding resources to pay Aaron yearly. In some cases, it's quite a nominal fee for end users, for example. But the importance of having the fee there every year is so that Aaron can maintain the relationship with the resource holder. And if that relationship goes stale, if they don't pay their bill, then Aaron can assume that the addresses are no longer in use and revoke them. The other point that's worth making is the IPv4 transfers. And there's two important points here. The first is transfers is another way to try and liberate unused addresses and get them to people who need them. So that way, rather than revoking or returning addresses, they can be transferred. But the other thing that's worth pointing out is when a transfer happens, the new organization that's receiving the addresses has to justify the usage of those. And you'll see here at the bottom in bold, if a company goes out of business regardless of any reason, the point of contact listed for the number resource does not have the authority to sell, transfer, assign, or give the number resource to any other person or organization. The point of contact must notify Aaron if a business fails so that the assigned number resources can be returned to the available pool of number resources if a transfer is not requested and justified. And additionally, in the event that the number resources of the combined organizations are no longer justified under Aaron policy, at the time Aaron becomes aware of the transaction through a transfer request or otherwise, Aaron will work with the resource holders to return, aggregate, transfer, or reclaim resources as needed to restore compliance via the process outlined in Aaron policy. So addresses are actually moving around. Aaron has recovered quite a bit of address space, and usually when they get a large block, they return them to IANA for redistribution. We now have a global policy that allows IANA to split what they're holding five ways and allocate them to the five RIRs. I also have some stats on LACNIC. They've done some recovery as well, nearly a /14 equivalent. Additionally, I was talking about transfers. There are transfers that are going on. So organizations that have addresses that are underutilized, they can sell those addresses to another organization and then transfer the resource. So this is just showing the number of transfers that have occurred in the APNIC region, as well as the number of transfers that occurred in the Aaron region. And the interesting thing about APNIC and Aaron is they have a bilateral arrangement in which you can transfer resources from one region to another. And you'll note that about half of the Aaron transfers were out of region to APNIC. There are also transfers going on in the RIPE region as well. These three regions are the most interesting because, as I said before, both RIPE and APNIC are essentially out because they're down to their last /8, which is reserved only for new organizations. And Aaron is interesting because it is nearly out, and it has a lot of legacy address space, and it has the ability to transfer addresses from the Aaron region to the APNIC region. So those are the three regions that typically report on transfers. So shifting gears and looking at V6 address space, you'll notice that these graphs look very different than IPv4. We're using a very small amount of V6 address space in the global routing system. And of that, each RIR has 1/12. And then there's an additional /12, which has some various registry space out of it. Those were the initial allocations that the RIRs got that were much smaller than 12. And you can also see the allocations that the RIRs are doing to their downstream customers and downstream ISPs.
And if I may just note, a couple slides back where it shows, very small slices. So this gives us a way to make policies without worrying too much that we're going to run into the same issues that people see we did with IPv4. We can make policies, there's some flexibility, and we can learn from them so that the next tiny slice can be better used. So go ahead.
So this graph here is showing the percentage of members that have both IPv4 and IPv6 broken down by region. The interesting thing here to note is that the RIPE region has the most widespread IPv6 adoption, contrary to the belief that everyone thinks that Asia is the continent that's running out and needs to embrace IPv6 strongly. So IPv6 allocation and assignment policy. And please do stop me if I'm saying strange words. We do have some fairly technical jargon. For example, allocation is a term that's typically used when an RIR makes a number resource available to an ISP who's going to then in turn make it available to a downstream organization. Assignment is when a number resource is given to an end site that will use the addresses themselves. and they don't have the ability to make further downstream reassignments or reallocations. So again, the best place to go and look for what is the policy for V6 initial allocations is the NRO Comparative RIR report at that same website. And if you look at it, the one thing that you'll find is that all of the RIRs provide a /32 by default to ISPs. ARIN is a little bit different in that their default is a /32, but upon request, you can ask for a /36 instead. The reason for this is the ARIN billing is based on different sized buckets. An extra small pays a certain amount a year, a small pays a certain amount of year, and a /32, because the address space is so large and because it covers, you know, a large majority of the ISPs that come to ARIN for an address space, that falls into the small bucket. So currently an extra small ISP and IPv4, as soon as they do IPv6, they're upgraded to a small and have to pay more. So in order to avoid that, they've offered a smaller /36, which is available upon request. N-site assignments typically start at /48. So digging in a little bit deeper, we can look at the AFRINIC policy. In terms of AFRINIC ISP allocations, the organization must be an ISP, not an N-site. They have to have plans to deploy IPv6 in Africa. They have to show plans to have downstream customers within a year and announce the IPv6 space to the Internet within a year. By default, they get a /32, but they can get larger than a /32 if they can justify it with their existing customer base and infrastructure. So you can basically count up all of your IPv4 customers and IPv4 infrastructure and assume that it would be doing IPv6 one day and get the appropriate addressing for all of that network and all of those customers. You qualify to come back and get additional space when your HD ratio of /48 is greater than 0.94. And what that means is basically they take the log of the /48s that are in use divided by the log of the total number of /48s that the organization is holding. In terms of N sites, you must be an N site and not what AFRINIC calls an LAR, which is an acronym for ISP, basically. You must be able to qualify for AFRINIC provider-independent IPv4 space. You don't actually have to hold it, but you have to be able to qualify for it under the current policies. And you must show a need for IPv6 provider-independent space. You must put it into service within 1 year, and you'll get a /48 by default, but you can get a larger block if it's justified. There's not really good guidelines on what is acceptable justification, though. For APNIC, also a default of a /32, if you already have IPv4 ISP address space from APNIC, you qualify for a /32 of IPv6 space. If you don't already have V4 ISP space, then you have to show all of these three things. You have to be an ISP and not an N-site. You have to have a plan for downstream customers and have a plan for at least 200 downstream customers in 2 years or provide IPv6 transit to customers within 2 years. You can get larger than a /32 based on your current customer base and infrastructure, assuming that it would all do V6. How much would you need? Or if your current IPv4 customer base and infrastructure plans to support IPv6 within 2 years. You can also get additional space with an HD ratio of 0.94, but in this case they look at /56s instead of 48s. And when you come back to get additional space, they allow for a 2-year supply. For N-sites, it's a /48. You need to have a provider-independent IPv4 address from APNIC or be multi-homed in IPv6 or demonstrate that an ISP block from an upstream ISP will not work. RIPE is also very similar. For an ISP allocation, you must be an ISP. You have to have plans for V6 customers in 2 years, and you get a /32 by default. They're a little bit more liberal than the other three in that you can request up to a 29 with no additional justification. Beyond a 29, it's based on your customer base and your infrastructure. And like the other two that we've seen, it's an HD ratio of 0.94 of slash 56s. For N sites, it's a slash 48, and it can be larger if it's justified by the number of subnets or the number of discrete routing sites. But they specifically state that you cannot reassign or reallocate these addresses. These are for use within your organization. You can't reassign them to downstream customers. LACNIC is very traditional and is the V6 initial allocation and assignment policy that we saw throughout the globe, but the others have drifted away from it over time. You must be an ISP. You must have a LACNIC IPv4 ISP address space, or if you have a plan for downstream customers using slash 48 and you announce the space within 12 months and you have downstream customers within the LACNIC region within 2 years, then you qualify. By default, it's a 32. You can get more based on a 4-year time horizon of what your projection is to need for V6 addresses the next 4 years, and that's based on your current customer and infrastructure as well as your projected growth of your current customers and infrastructures. You can also assign aggregates to POPs or parts of your network, but those parts of your network have to be at least 30% utilized. You also get additional address space with an HD ratio of 0.94 of slash 48. You can get a 2-year supply, and if you got your addresses and you come back within 6 months and you decided you asked for the wrong amount, you can return what you got and reapply as an initial allocation again. The ARIN policy is one of the most complicated, but also one of the most liberal. ARIN has decided that they only want to give out ISP blocks on nibble boundaries, which is basically counting by fours. So you can do a 36, a 32, a 28, a 24, et cetera. By default, it's a 32, but as I said previously, you can request a 36 to reduce your billing. And the way they decide how much you can get is they basically look at the amount of address space you need to basically look at your largest serving site. So if you imagine that you're aggregating customers on edge routers, you could pick your edge router with the largest number of customers. You could say that you're giving all of your customers a slash 48 each, count up how many 48s you need for that edge router, round that up to the nearest siter, and then you can use that block size to give to every edge router in your network. And then when you add up all of those blocks from all of your edge routers, you round that up to the nearest nibble. And if you're very close to the nearest nibble, you round it up to the nibble above that. So basically the idea here is to give a large oversizing to allow people to easily manage and grow their networks. You must have downstream customers and either be an ARIN IPv4 ISP, be IPv6 multi-homed, or have a plan for 50 IPv6 customers within 5 years. And you can get additional address space when any of the three occur. If you're 75% total utilization, if you're at 90% utilization at any single serving site, or if 90% of your serving site blocks have been allocated and are still justified. Generally what they'll do is they will bump you up to the next nibble until you reach a slash 12, and at that point they will just give you a slash 12 at a time. For N sites, just like everyone else, it's a slash 48. You must either be an IPv4 N site holding provider independent space from ARIN, or be multi-homed, or use 2,000 IPv6 addresses within 1 year, or have 200 slash 64 size subnets in 1 year. And you can get larger if you can justify it by the number of subnets or the number of discrete routing locations. So I think you all wanted to know how can you get involved in making RIR policy. So what is an RIR? An RIR is a regional internet registry. They're established in ICP2, which you can find on the ICANN website. And they're basically defined as operating a continental-sized international geography, have broad support of their community, have bottom-up self-governance, they're open, they're transparent, they're neutral and impartial, and they have technical expertise and adhere to the global policies of conservation, aggregation, and registration. So they've basically gone and divided up the globe into 5 continental-sized regions. Aaron has North America and the English-speaking Caribbean. RIPE has Europe. APNIC has Asia and the Pacific. AFRINIC has Africa. And LACNIC has Latin America and the non-English Caribbean. Each RIR establishes its own regional policy. Each RIR has its own policy development process. And this policy is developed from the community in a bottom-up manner. It's consensus-based. They all have open policy mailing lists and open public policy meetings, and it's all transparent. Their policy development process is documented, and their number policy is documented. So there are some differences in flavor, but generally each RIR has its own published policy manual. They each have their own policy development process. And then they publish draft policies that are under discussion. They're discussed on the mailing list and in meetings, which happen twice a year. They're open, and they also allow remote participation. So generally the way it works is any individual in the community or a group of individuals can submit a proposal. The community discusses that proposal on the mailing list. Staff provides their assessment in terms of how they operate. They also provide a legal assessment if there's a legal impact. The community will discuss these proposals at an open public policy meeting. They will judge if there is consensus, and if there is, they will move it to last call. The board will do a fiduciary risk assessment. After that, it gets adopted or ratified and implemented. Global policy is a policy that requires the IANA to do something toward the RIRs. In this case, you have to pass 5 regional policies that all have the same language. So it follows each of the normal regional policy development processes in all of the 5 regions. And then it gets passed to the NRO for review and up to the ICANN board. So once the same policy is passed in all 5 regions, the NRONC validates that the proposal went through the correct policy development process in each region, that it was discussed for the right amount of time, that it was posted on a mailing list for the right amount of time, that there had been adequate consideration of viewpoints. They also have to judge if the same policy has passed in all 5 regions, because sometimes the same text doesn't actually make it through all regions, but it's essentially the same policy. Sometimes the NROEC will rewrite the policy and it is a substantive change, in which case the NRONC will send it back to the communities because it's not the policy that was passed. If the NRO judges that it followed the right process and that the same policy passed in all 5 regions, then it will recommend to the ICANN board to ratify it, and the ICANN board can ratify it. They can sit on it, which it then becomes ratified by default. They can ask for clarification, or they can send it back to specifically reconsider certain concerns. So I have a bunch of slides for the 5 RIRs that basically give you the pointers to where all of these documents are. So if you are particularly interested in, say, the Aran region, you could go find their number resource policy manual, read it, see what the current policy is, pull down their draft policies that are currently under discussion, read them. You could join the mailing list. You could certainly comment on those draft policies and say whether you're in support or against them or how the language could be changed to be better. And you can certainly attend any of the RIR meetings. They're open. So I've listed where the meetings are and when they are and the websites where you can find those meetings. So with that, I guess we'll hand back the microphone and open it up for questions.
Well, thank you very much. It's Olivier Krapanovno speaking. That was, I would say, quite involved, and some of it might have been a little technical, we've seen in the chat in there. Thank you very much for going through this. It's quite fascinating. It's a world that our community doesn't know that very much about. I have a few questions, but I'll first open the floor for questions from others, questions and comments. from others here, and then we'll take a few more minutes for the questions that I do have. Anyone wish to start? I don't see anyone putting their hand up, so maybe I can send a few questions. The first thing is, we've seen all of this, the IANA and the RIRs and all of the address policy making and so on. You know, and this is really sort of playing devil's advocate in a way. How important are the IRRs and how important is the mission of the RIR? Could we just get rid of them and have numbers directly allocated from IANA and the ESO with an ICANN doing the policy?
Olivier, may I answer?
Yes, please, if you introduce yourself.
Sure, I'm Leo Vigoda from ICANN. I spoke earlier. I work in the IANA department. Just on the issue of do we need the RIRs or could it all be done by IANA, the RIRs have significant staffs and significant memberships. I believe, for instance, the RIPE NCC has in excess of 9,000 members, and we have we have just a couple of people who provide service to the RIRs, and we're not at the moment scaled up to provide service to literally tens of thousands of customers around the world. I think that the hierarchical distribution system is an advantage, and it means that people get good customer service in their own time zone, and there's language support where that's required, and all sorts of things that are very difficult to build into a single organization. So I think you could argue that the RIRs, for that specific reason, aren't absolutely essential, but I think that things would be significantly worse without them.
The other, Jason Schiller, the other thing, too, is that having the five different regions allows for regional variations, which there is quite a bit of. And in addition to the needs of the region being different, there's also cultural differences. If you attend an ARIN meeting, you'll find that the Americans and the Canadians tend to be very vocal. They like to argue. And they're very anal in terms of making sure the policy language is just right. And they kind of view it as, you know, if I'm in a court of law and I need to get the addresses that I think I deserve and I'm held to the letter of this policy, would that be a good thing for my company and for the Internet as a whole? When you go to another region, say like the Asia-Pacific region, it's much less confrontational. A lot of the discussions happen in one-on-one, and a lot of times you'll hear them say things like, you know, the actual text of this policy doesn't really say what we all know what we want it to be, but we're all comfortable that, you know, the principle is sound and we'll go ahead and we'll pass it and we all know what it means. So I think that there's also a lot of value in terms of allowing for the regional differences. And I think because of the cultural sensitivities and because the process is bottom-up and involved, you know, with an open community, I think it would be much harder for that to be successful at an international body, whether that be, you know, ICANN or IANA or somewhere else.
Very, very interesting. It's Olivier speaking. Very interesting indeed. As you know, the at-large community is divided in its five regions, and we find this to be particularly important for the balance of inputs that we get from the different parts of the world. And I think you'll hear many echo exactly what you've explained there with regards to how culture plays a very big part in the way things run. There's a question from Evan Liebowitz. Unfortunately, he's not able to speak at the moment, but he's texted this over to me. And so I'll read it over to the record, and then either of you can decide on responding to it. So here's the question. Given that this is an at-large audience, how would you describe efforts to advance the IPv4 depletion as an issue that matters to end users. Most of them don't see a problem, and NAT techniques, network address translation, seems to get more advanced, so most don't even know what's happening underneath. How are end users impacted, and how can they be motivated to take this issue as their own?
So I don't think end users should actually know what their IP address is or whether they're using IPv4 or IPv6. I don't think they should care. They should be able to get to the Internet, and it should work. But their upstream providers need to be very concerned. Their upstream providers are the ones that need continued IP addresses for growth of their customer base, or they need to deploy a carrier-grade NAT-type solution. And a lot of people have concerns about how well carrier-grade NAT will work, because it basically has to be an application-level gateway. It has to understand all of the applications that it's letting through, so it has to be SIP aware, it has to be FTP aware, and so on and so forth. So there are issues with that. But beyond that, people are also concerned about the scalability of it and the performance of it. So it depends on where you deploy your carrier-grade NAT inside your network topology. If it's very close to where you terminate your customers, then it's going to be a very expensive solution. But there's not a lot of latency and there's not a lot of bottlenecking as you funnel all the traffic through the CGN device. If you deploy it more centrally, then that brings costs down quite a bit, but it increases the latency because you have to funnel all of your traffic and haul it back to wherever that CGN point is. And it can also potentially be a bottleneck. There's also privacy concerns. When you're running a CGN, you basically have to keep your TCP-level transaction information. So if law enforcement shows up and says, you know, we need to know who posted this child pornography, they might have the IP address and the port of who hit the web server, but that IP address might be shared by 1,000 people. So the ISP will have to go back through their logs and figure out exactly what inside address is using which outbound port in order to map it to a particular unique individual. And that basically means they're keeping TCP-level transactions. They're knowing every website you visited, and they're recording that, and they're holding it for 5 or 7 years. So there are certainly privacy concerns with regard to that. The other issue is Konami, which is a game manufacturer in Japan. They're going around and talking about the implications of having CGN NAT in terms of performance for cutting-edge gamers who want, you know, the best throughput and the lowest latency to their servers for their gaming performance. So some of the power users may be concerned about going through a CGN. But I think all in all, it's either going to work well and people aren't going to notice and care, or some things are going to break. And in that case, you know, people are going to choose, do I go with my current provider that's forcing me to go through a CGN that impacts what I can do, or do I switch to their competitor that still has IPv4 addresses and won't make me go through a CGN, or their competitor that's deployed IPv6 because it just so happens I'm an Xbox One customer and it does IPv6, and IPv6 works perfectly well for everything I want to do.
Thank you, Jason. Louis?
I would add that for the users who do hear about IPv6, they can help the effort by asking their ISPs if IPv6 is supported on their connection. And with the idea that in not too long, if you're IPv4 only, you're not on the whole Internet anymore. You're only a part of the Internet. So ask to be on the whole Internet is what I would say. For those users that are that know enough about, you know, V4, V6, and if they want to be involved in the effort. But otherwise, we are pushing for enterprises to have them ask their ISPs, they spend more money on a per user basis than your home customers. So the enterprises, for their business continuity to be able to reach all the internet, will need to be also on IPv6. For that to happen, they have to ask their ISPs. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Louis, and it's Olivier here. I mean, obviously, that would be valid if there was some IPv6-only content, but is there at the moment IPv6-only content? I thought most of it is just dual stack.
Yes, there is. I've just posted a URL for an IPv6-only puzzle game into the chat room.
Very quick on the trigger, Leo. Thank you very much, Olivier speaking. The threat of loss of privacy and the slowdown with NAT and all that, I mean, isn't this just all scaremongering in a way?
I don't know that that's well known, to be honest. I think NAT technologies used in the customer premise equipment at the home has been in place for a long, long time, but that's not really what we're talking about here. We're talking about provider-based NAT and potentially two levels of NAT, where they might be doing NAT inside the provider's network and then NAT again at the household. This type of equipment is still very immature and is not well tested. I don't personally have any experience to know, you know, whether the performance is an issue and how good the ALGs are. But I think many of us have experience with the pains of living with firewalls, especially when new protocols come out, and those pains certainly are going to be identical on a CGN platform.
Wow, it's Olivia speaking again. So effectively what you're saying is the CGN technology is less proven than IPv6 technology.
So I think IPv6 works well in a native deployment, and I think IPv4 works well in a native deployment. And I think most residential users haven't had native IPv4 for a long time. The typical solution is to give a single public IP address to the customer premise equipment and then do NAT behind that. IPv6 allows you to reestablish the end-to-end connectivity between things on the Internet. And it gives you enough addresses to continue to grow, and it gives you enough addresses to put things on the Internet as opposed to just people. I mean, people talk about toasters and cars and all kinds of devices on the Internet. So I think there is real gains in IPv6. The challenge here is, what do we do in the short term, where some networks haven't deployed dual-stack IPv4 and IPv6, and we start to see networks running out of IPv4 addresses? Are we in a place where an ISP can just turn up IPv6-only customers? You know, imagine if at your house you were to buy new Internet service and they just give you an IPv6 address, and they say, you can get to all of the Internet, but just the things that are on IPv6. I mean, how would your browsing experience be? So the question is, what do we do? Well, yes, we should try to encourage all of the sites on the Internet to get to dual stack and to get to it before people start building V6-only networks, but we haven't been very successful with that. So the alternative is to go through some sort of carrier-grade NAT-type solution. The big question is, do people think that carrier-grade NAT is going to be a long-term solution, meaning IPv6 is not important, or will people move to native IPv6 in a real way and to only use carrier-grade NAT for a smaller and smaller number of edge cases where the service hasn't deployed V6?
Thank you. Yaovi?
Thank you. Yaovi speaking. My question is to know the reason why somebody can turn on an IPv6 network only now, as he knows that some people may not be able to reach him. That is my question. Thank you.
So, I mean, the challenge is if you're in Asia or you're in Europe and you are an ISP that already has IPv4 addresses, you're going to continue to use those IPv4 addresses as you add new customers to your network. But at some point, your store of IPv4 is only so large and you run out. The question is, what will that provider do? So this is where you have to make a difficult decision of, can I just turn up IPv6 only customers? It would be great if I could, because then I just transition my growth to IPv6 and life is good for everyone. Or do I have to get CGN equipment, deploy it, support it, figure out what are the latencies and throughputs of it and the impact, and try to position my service to be as good or priced better than my competitors that haven't been driven to CGN yet? So the other interesting point here is everyone is going to run out at different times, and that's going to create a competitive advantage. And then, you know, beyond that, the question is, well, does it make money to spend money on a CGN solution? How many customers will I lose if I just do V6 only? Sure, Facebook does V6 and Google does V6, and maybe that's all my customers care about. But, you know, beyond that is the question, too, of, you know, IPv4 transfers. Do I go out and buy IP addresses on the market? And how much is an IP address worth to me to be able to grow my business? And how much revenue am I extracting from a customer, and how much of that do I have to turn around and put into purchasing IPv4 addresses? And then theoretically at some point, you know, the Internet goes widespread dual stack, IPv6 is supported everywhere, and then at that point I can just do my future growth in IPv6 only. And the question is, well, when will that happen? And how does that change my investments? And, you know, if that happens in the next 2 years, what do I do with all of the CGN NAT equipment that I've purchased that is now no longer useful for anything else? So it's actually a very challenging proposition for providers to figure out, you know, what are they going to do as they face IPv4 scarcity.
Thank you, Jason. Olivier speaking. It just sounds like this is all just financial, ultimately. The vector for change will apparently be at all stages be a financial one, wouldn't it?
Yeah, unfortunately. I mean, 10 years ago, IETF decided to make IPv4 and IPv6 not compatible on the wire. And they said the transition plan is for all of the Internet to go dual stack before the first network goes V6 only. And had we done that, everything would be fine. Unfortunately, people are trying to defer the cost of doing V6. And they're trying to do that because V6 doesn't generate any new revenue or new services or capabilities. All it does is allow them to have business continuity. And everyone agrees that they need business continuity and that they need to deploy V6. The challenge is they want to deploy V6 just before they run out of V4. And the problem that this creates is not everyone is going to run out at the same time. So rather than getting the Internet as a whole to be dual stack before the first network runs out of V4 addresses, each individual network is trying to figure out the date on which they will run out of V4 and for them to do V6 in a real way. And the problem is, if you're early on that curve, if you're one of the first organizations to run out of V4, then you're going to be stuck for a while until the rest of them run out.
Okay, that's a very good description. Thank you very much for this. I cannot help having visions of the Titanic when hearing this, but it certainly seems that we are thinking slowly, and hopefully the transition will be smooth. I'm mindful of the time. It is already 17 minutes past the hour. Any other question from anyone? Otherwise, I had one last question that would take us out of the IPv6, the pure IPv6 discussion. I see no one putting their hand up. So the question I had was with regards to the RIR policy development. How important is it for, I guess, end users, if anyone in our community, what would be the reasons why they would be interested in participating in RIR policy development? And I guess the extension to this, would they be able to do so as well?
So the second question is much easier to answer. Absolutely, individuals can participate in the policy development process. Even when a company or an organization sends someone to an errand meeting, it's very clear that everyone participates as individuals, although their opinions are influenced by their perspective and their employment. Certainly if you work for a transit provider, you see a lot of the issues with policies that impact transit providers. But in terms of participation, we all participate as individuals. And it is an open, bottom-up, transparent process. Anyone can show up at an RIR meeting and participate. Anyone can join the mailing list and chime in on draft policy proposals. And if you think a policy needs to be changed, you can certainly draft a proposal or even just send in a suggestion and get others to help you write a proposal. So certainly getting involved, attending the meetings, speaking up on the mailing list, all of the documentation about what current policy is and current proposals that are being discussed is all publicly available on the RIR website. So it's very easy to get involved. In terms of why you should get involved, these policies really inform how IP addresses and AS numbers are given out to providers and in turn to their customers, as well as to direct end site organizations. So if you're a customer of, a typical transit provider of, say, a Comcast or a Level 3, it's important that you know that your provider is working in a policy framework where they can get the addresses that they need and that they're using them responsibly, which means they can continue to add new customers so that when you move to your new home, you can go and buy internet service and know that you can get an address and you'll be able to use it. There are some policies that directly affect end users. There are policies where if you are an end user with a static IP assignment, you are no longer required to publicly publish which IP address belongs to which end user. For corporations, it's still required. And that's a change that happened a few years ago, and it was mostly driven by the Canadian law enforcement. There's also recently been a discussion about whether RIRs should give IP addresses directly to individuals. A long time ago, if you were an individual and you talked to John Postel and you said, hi, I'd like a /24 for my house, you could get one. Today, in the Aaron region, you have to be an organization in order to get IP addresses. So you would have to create a sole proprietorship and use that to get the addresses. Part of the complexity here is the reason why Aaron has structured it that way is because they're trying to reduce fraud. So they want to make sure that IP addresses are given to legal entities that they can verify, and it's much more difficult for them to verify that when an individual comes to them and claims to be an individual that they actually are who they say they are. So that's probably a topic that we're going to be discussing in the next 6 months or so in the Aaron region.
That's Olivia speaking. That's something which actually I guess does affect end users. And one last question, and I did notice here that there was a question or a comment from David Antelik saying on the chat whether transcripts and recordings of the meetings were publicly available for those who were not able to attend. Are these all archived?
This is Barbara. For most of the RIR meetings, there are very good remote participation capabilities. The archiving of them, as usual with these things, may take a little time to make them available after the fact. But all of the RIRs are in fact quite good about enabling remote participation during the meetings.
Yeah, so definitely at the Aaron meeting, you can tune into the video stream They have a Jabber client that you can ask questions in after a policy is discussed in order to determine if there's consensus. They ask for a show of hands. You can virtually raise your hand in the Jabber room and be counted. These videos are also available after the fact to be watched. So you can go back and say, you know, a week or two, and, you know, we had discussed this policy, and what did we decide? And you can go back and replay it and watch it. And Aaron also does publish a fairly good transcript of the meeting also, but that takes a few weeks to come out. But if you go to YouTube, you can actually see some of the Aaron meeting sessions. They're still putting them up. That was just 2 weeks back. But yeah, the meetings are all there, and you can go back in time and look at older meetings as well.
That's a Ricardo Petaros, the defender.
Yes, just to complement, as Jason mentioned, LACNIC also have the compromise to publish records of the meetings. And one interesting factor in our case, our meetings are translated from Spanish to English, from Spanish to Portuguese, and also the other way around. This is a way to facilitate the participation from different regions. And all the recording of the meetings are available on the website. And also, one can check the history of the policy development. As other IIRs, we have a page where one can find proposals presented in the past, if the proposal was reached consensus or not. All this information is publicly available on the website.
Thank you, Ricardo. I realize we are running out of time. It's nearly reaching half the hour. Just one last question, and in fact, maybe even a suggestion. Are there any beginner's guides to all of what you've just told us today? So both beginner's guide to IPv6 and beginner's guide to RIRs and to RIR policy development?
Olivier, Leo Vigoda speaking. I just want to let you know that we're finishing up the editing on a new beginner's guide that ICANN should be publishing. We're hoping to have it available in Buenos Aires in at least English and Spanish, although it will be eventually translated into all the UN languages. And I know that the RIRs also publish all sorts of material as well.
Yeah, certainly all the RIRs publish very good descriptions of the policy development process, the PDP, and that basically walks you through what is the process from an idea to that becoming a RIR policy. So that documentation is very good. In terms of getting involved, I would say at least for the Aaron region, we have an elected body called the Aaron Advisory Council. They, from time to time, do mentor people as part of a mentorship program that's actually formalized. But they're also very good about, you know, holding new individuals' hands and working with them if they have a consideration or a suggestion for how policy should be changed. So it certainly is possible to come in as a new individual, completely new to the whole process, find an Aaron Advisory Council member, and, you know, borrow their ear and say, you know, I'm really concerned about this potential policy and it really should do that instead. And they will certainly work with you to actually write a policy proposal. They'll submit it to the community, and they'll shepherd you and the policy through the whole process.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. I look forward to seeing this beginner's guide, somebody is speaking. I think the ALAC is going to be meeting with the ASO for half an hour in Buenos Aires. I hope that by that time you'll have a beginner's guide with you and you'll be able to bring it over to our members. It certainly will shed a lot more light over what the ASO does, what the RIRs do, what the ASO Address Council does, and how does one get involved more in addressing policy around the world? We keep on hearing about this world, but being a part of those mailing lists, I notice an entirely different world taking place out there with very few hardcore ICANNers from the rest of ICANN being part of it. So I entirely welcome this this beginner's guide, and I look forward to seeing it, and no doubt many of our members will be very interested in reading it. With this, I thank absolutely all of you for having come on the call. Thank you very much, Jason, Ricardo, Barbara Roseman as well, who is on the call as well, and of course, Leo Vigoda. Thank you for having arranged this. It's been certainly very helpful for me and for my colleagues. This is recorded, so hopefully we'll be able to, I'm sure, Heidi, will we be able to publicize this over to our members and also sort of make up a page to have the PDF presentations, please?
Yes, we can add all that additional information to our agenda page. Olivier, this is Heidi.
That's fantastic. Thank you very, very much. Thanks to all of you. Apologies for the late end to this call, but it's a big subject and it's one that we don't often visit. So it's good to have been able to go into it with a little bit more depth than usual. And with this, I thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and goodbye. This call is now adjourned. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Oh.